Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
We have heard three inspirational, excellent speakers this morning, coming to afternoon, and it's your opportunity to ask them questions. And at the same time, I'll remind our viewers on the web from Scotland, from Wales, from England, wherever you are, ask questions. So over to you. And as usual, please make sure you stand up, introduce yourselves, and ask the question. Anyone? We have got a question at the back.
Testing. Okay, thank you. Paul Jackson from CIPR. I'm always happy to ask questions. Can I ask about these cultural issues? Two of you have mentioned that I'm sure Ian knows of cultural barriers and things that you've got to contend with. But we often talk about these things, but what do they mean in concrete terms? You've said they're very important. You surveyed for cultural differences in one instance. What are they exactly, and how do you need to grapple with them in these cases?
Thank you very much. Shall we start?
I think, to put it simply, culture is basically the way we do things here. It's the us, how we conduct ourselves. It's, you know, part of Jewish mission and vision and the sort of values that drive an organisation. But what we did when we did our cultural survey, we surveyed where we thought the culture was just now, but we also asked staff to tell us the kind of culture they wanted for the new college, and from that we could identify a cultural gap. So it's like, this is where we are. It was very clear, this is where we are and this is where we want to be and this is what we need to do to get there. So it was almost like creating a roadmap.
Can you just give me a sense of some of the instances, some of the particular values or forms of behaviour you're looking at?
It's about things like empowerment versus control. One of the cultures, and one of the three colleges, was a very controlling culture, whereas the other two were much more about empowering staff. So that was a really important one. It was about the sort of can-do. Don't give me 10 reasons why you can't do something. Just do it. Very, very simple things. And about valuing staff and valuing the students.
So, thank you. Yeah, thank you very much. Any more offers to do? Did you want to say something?
I think from our perspective, obviously doing the process re-engineering workshops enabled people to air their concerns and to actually come to a level of understanding about what we meant by shared services. So it really did help in terms of the management of change process. And they're already using those processes in their areas of work now. So when they move across to a shared services entity, it's far less threatening for them to do that. They see it completely differently to when we started off in 2010.
Thank you. Ian?
I just come from a practical perspective. Two schools had to come together with two different sponsors, and there was a sharing of services, and there was a controlling element of one, and the other was just as Kathy described, where one was more about empowering people. Where we got to really was that we had to start with what our shared vision was and build a culture from that, identify what are we all in this for, and really we're all involved in helping people, students, young people. That's where we start and build a culture based on a shared vision. That's a rather strategic and airy-fairy kind of thought. But if you don't share a vision, it won't work anyway.
Thank you for that very detailed answer, and I'm very content with what you have just said. We have got two questions on the floor first. Shall we come here in the front, and then we'll go at the back?
Hi, Colin Booth from Barnsley College. Question for Kathy, or two questions actually, both very practical. I may have misunderstood this, but you've got a joint venture company and shared services provided to more than one college. How do you decide how much to charge a college for an HR service? Because presumably they're different sizes and have different demands and have different internal systems that make different... How do you do that?
It's very simple, actually. We go by the size of the college as a starting point. So at the moment, we've got a very small sixth form in the partnership, which is a £5 million turnover. And on the other hand, we've got a £50 million organisation. And so your starting point is going to be size. And so from there, you then unpick, well, what is it that you want from the HR service? What is the service level agreement that you're wanting to enter into? Because these are the standardised processes. And for your size, this is what it would actually cost.
Okay, thank you. Are you happy with that?
Yeah. But sorry, can I just... Okay. But it's not for profit. There is absolutely no profit in it at all. So the people who are providing the service are always looking to make those processes leaner and smarter.
Thank you, Cathy. Question at the back.
We have an online question from Des to the panel. Why give 3 years no compulsory when you have no agreement of flexibility from teaching unions?
Okay, who is going to tackle that particular question from the panel?
I'm not entirely sure what they're asking.
Do you want to repeat the question? Panel is not sure what the question is.
He said, why give 3 years no compulsory when you have no agreement of flexibility from teaching unions?
All right, okay. I think they're two separate issues. We put the commitment to no compulsory redundancies in place up front in 2010 from the point of merger. The negotiations with the unions to try and reach agreement on terms and conditions has taken a long time. And the ballot that I refer to that rejected what we've got on the table actually only took place just at the beginning of this academic year. So they actually are two separate issues.
Okay. Thank you very much. There is a question here in the front.
Hello, yes. Neville Cannon, Plymouth City Council again. Two questions, one for Candy and Cathy. Candy, you talked about the economic regeneration aspects of that project. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that. And then for Cathy, assuming that organisations have made the emotional break to go to a shared service JVC company, presumably you think that if you don't delight the customer, that it's that much easier for them to move away to another hosted company or a cloud or anything else. So I don't know if you'd like to say anything about that.
Shall we start?
Okay, I'll start. I think in terms of the contribution to the local economic regeneration, it's the ability to work closer and better, actually, with local employers to actually deliver what they need. So, the college is a part of the local economic commission in the city. Over and above the merger project, we've also got the £200 million construction project coming on board, which is going to create a lot of jobs and make a significant contribution to economic regeneration.
In a way, that critical mass gives you the influence with employers working more closely and so on. Mm-hmm. So probably that's...
It's easier for employers to work with us.
Yes, one of the things that HM Treasury and HMRC put into the cost-sharing exemption ruling was that organisations could be part of more than one cost-sharing group. And so clearly, if you're not delighted with the services that you're getting, then you can move to another group who will provide the types of services that you would demand.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Cathy. Any further questions? Yes, sir. Question there.
Andy Gannon from the 157 Group. Christine referred earlier to the fact that I'm working on the project that Stella will be talking about this afternoon. I'm interested in the distinction you're making between backroom services and frontline, and our project is very much about curriculum design and delivery. I wanted to ask Ian in particular, with your collaboration, if you like, across sectors, are you doing any collaboration in terms of curriculum design and delivery, or do you see that happening in the future? Because it strikes me that there are benefits not just for the students but also professionally for the staff involved in the two sectors there.
Mm-hmm. Ian?
I'm trying to pick all that. I'm a pragmatist, and I would go to Gloucestershire College and say, here are my students, what's the best thing for them? And we work it that way. But at the moment, there's a provider there, or a partner, sponsor, who is equally committed to looking at the students and saying what we're going to do for them. And then we get the solution, and then we're working out the detail. For instance, some of the detail may be around delivery of catering use in the academy. What's going to happen? Who gets paid at what rate? Very much that is on the back burner. Get it right for the students, and we'll make the finances work out afterwards. And I'm afraid it sounds a rather naive solution in this particular audience. But unless you're quite radical enough to take sometimes those naive solutions to problems, you don't get answers that fit, and students and learners just are left to the back, but they're left to the side. You know, who are we here for? We're becoming a market-focused industry. Our market is students and learners. If you're going to win the market, then you're going to be meeting their needs. My biggest fear about curriculum design is about employment, quite frankly. What jobs am I preparing my students for? That's what breaks me. I've got lots of young lads, lots of energy, lots of creative ideas, and I'm preparing them for catering jobs, because they're about, and I'm catering them for... Well, there's lots of ICT jobs, but they are very, very high-calibre jobs. My biggest issue for education is, what am I preparing my students for? The thing that we're devoted to as much as anything about curriculum is giving them the work skills, aptitudes, socialisation to prepare them for a flexible working environment in the future. And an unseen part of the curriculum, and I think it should be a seen part of the curriculum, is how we develop socialisation in many young people and aptitudes for working with adults in different cultures, because it's going to be a flexible workplace in the future. And I'm not so sure that any curriculum design has got the answer below perhaps for students who are going to be in the top 25% of earners in the future. That's my candid response. I see a few nods around the room, so I suspect we all feel that we're working a little bit in that context. We've got a young generation of people with a very uncertain future, and curriculums have got to be designed to help them have a flexible approach to their career and life and future. I don't think I've been practical enough for you. Would you like to qualify the question again?
That's a brilliant answer.
Yes, very helpful answer. I suppose it's whether you see there's any kind of benefit to collaboration in producing that curriculum that I think lots of us around the room think is needed, but
absolutely,
maybe we're not there yet.
We cannot produce, as an academy, the right curriculum on our own for the kind of students that we have. Yeah. It's easy to produce a curriculum for the top quartile of students because it's English, maths, science, history, etc. But there's another three quartiles, and it's very difficult to produce the right curriculum for them, and we need as many partners in that as possible.
Thank you, Ian. Very impressive way of describing that. Obviously, we are in the danger of creating a lost generation, and there are young people who can benefit with certain type of curriculum, and one reason only for you is to work with people who will provide these students that curriculum so that they move to employment. Yeah. So, brilliant. Excellent. Any further questions from the floor? Yes, sir, at the back.
Julian Blake from Bates, Hawes & Braithwaite Solicitors. I'd just like to make...
Sorry, missed your name. And
it's Julian Blake from Bates, Hawes & Braithwaite Solicitors. Just like to make an observation about Cathy's observation on how far you need legal advice or not. And it's from a legal perspective, and I'm involved very much in social enterprise, in public services, in the education area. And it's right that you describe legal models that are readily available, readily applicable to lots of different... circumstances. It's a very familiar model. And I'm not saying that the legal thing is more important than the practical. In fact, I'm saying absolutely the reverse. It's working out the commercial side. It's working out how all the complicated things you described and then applying it. And, you know, it's not just applying it within a legal model that's pre-constructed. There's a big application process that's secondary to working out the commercial matters in detail. So don't discount the legal component.
Thank you very much for your advice. While people are asking for thinking of further questions, I have got one question for Cathy. Cathy, I was quite disturbed to hear that you have been through takeover and you have been through merger. I can understand going through a takeover, you will have scars, but going through a merger, you still have scars. That disturbs me. So if that's the case, what is the difference between takeover and merger?
Essentially, both takeover and merger will have some kind of impact on curriculum management staff, teaching staff, and then inevitably learners. And that's the perspective that I am trying to describe here, that learners become very aware when people feel uncertain. And it doesn't matter what kind of model you put in terms of merger or a takeover, it's an uncertain landscape.
If we only allow that to happen, yes?
Well, as I tried to allude earlier on, we thought we had the best communication strategy and we communicated even when there was nothing to communicate. And staff, you know, it's the human element. Staff inevitably still felt uncertain.
Okay, thank you very much. Any further questions? If not, I'm sure then you are hungry for lunch. It's a very warm day as well. Enjoy your lunch, and we will be back after lunch. Thank you very much, and to the panel.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.